All of us are on a journey of becoming, a never-ending journey in pursuit of truth and deeper union with the divine. As you know, faith is a complicated thing, and this journey of becoming can be both difficult and painful. Far too often, we have not been given a space where we can safely address the complications and issues that arise naturally. My name is Joshua Patterson, and I am also on this journey of becoming. I am dedicated to inviting you into my story and creating a space where questions and critical thinking are welcome. I want to take an honest look at the issues and questions so common to this shared journey. I want to genuinely seek out what it means to follow Jesus in our ever-changing world, in our unfolding and expanding universe, and in our pluralistic society. I have come to know that doubt is not the enemy of faith, but rather that both doubt and curiosity are two of faith's biggest allies. I have learned that the Christian faith is more about wisdom and love than it is about correct doctrine or belief. And I believe that we are being invited to continually seek out both wisdom and love, renewing our minds, expanding our hearts, and rethinking our faith in the process. Thank you for joining me on that journey. All right, friends, welcome to another episode of the Rethinking Faith podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and please join me in welcoming back to the podcast for their second appearance, Philip Clayton. Phil, how are we doing, I guess, this afternoon for you?
Yeah, hey, it's great to be back on the show, Josh, and I'm excited to see where this conversation will go. This could be light and fanciful, and it could be deep and profound, and we'll see where you take us.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. I'm excited as well. And you'll have to forgive me. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. Listeners might, who listen to me talk a lot more. I have something I'm trying to get over. I don't know what it is, but my voice might be a little bit scratchy or off. Might crack.
Your voice feels,
I promise.
You'll find, but I can feel those germs coming through the mic already.
Yeah, right. We need to shut that technology down. Maybe create some kind of like AI, germ stopper that lives in the inner workings of the computer, you know, however.
By the way, I do have the AI summary function here working on my side of the Zoom. And so If we don't like the show, we'll just let the AI summary play it instead.
Perfect. That works great. I love it.
I gave her a kind of sexy 1940s movie star voice, and she'll be summarizing our conversation for us if the listeners don't like what we come up with.
I love it. That'll be like a sub podcast of Rethinking Faith. We'll just do the regular episodes and then this cool AI generated version. And watch AI kick my butt, you know, get more downloads and all this kind of stuff.
We're going to call it AI Rethinks Faith. And yeah, watch out, your job may be on the line.
I know, it's not good. Oh, man. Well, Phil, I've said this already, but thank you so much for coming back. I'm excited to talk. I really enjoyed our previous conversation we had together, which, listeners, if you didn't hear that, it was about panentheism. And it was a really fun conversation. And so you can go back and find that in the archives, so to speak, if you are interested, which you should be. But maybe for the listeners who didn't hear that episode, could you just like maybe briefly introduce yourself? Let us know a little bit about who you are and what kind of things you find yourself doing.
Yeah. So right now I have a sort of triple or quadruple identity. So I'm Ingram Professor of Theology at Claremont School of Theology. I've been here for a while. Had a chance to work with 40 amazing doctoral students over the years, including Trip Fuller, whose name is likely to come up in today's conversation. As the climate crisis grew worse, I launched an international nonprofit called the Institute for Ecological Civilization, or ecociv.org, and I'm putting a lot of time into working with food, water, and work. So water supply in Africa, food and agriculture, and well-being economies, with the hope of getting people's eyes beyond the hopelessness of the moment to what a long-term achieving of the outcome of an ecological society would look like. I'm right now serving as a trustee on the John Templeton Foundation, so I continue to think a lot about science and religion. And I'm still writing books. Got three books coming out in the next couple of 6 months.
Wonderful. Now that's just three more reasons to hang out with you again, you know.
You got it.
Well, yeah, so I'm for this particular conversation, what I thought would be fun is kind of do a little bit of a teaser of sorts. There's a class that you mentioned, Trip Fuller, Homebrewed Christianity, is going to be hosting, called The Cosmic Christ, Advent and the Coming of God. And so it'll be yourself, it'll be Trip Fuller, and also a mutual friend, Diana Butler Bass, which is a really fun group of people. So that'll be a fun class.
Especially since she and I were at Westmont College together some years ago. I think I was a senior when she was a freshman, and we had these conversations where I thought, now this is a woman who really is going to go someplace. And she was completely, like, she was DBB, even as a freshman at Westmont. Now, the content of what she says has changed, but the DBB-ness has never changed in all those years.
I love that. That's awesome. I remember when I had her on the show, it came up that I'm in Baltimore. And we deduced somehow that the library, that if I stand on my front porch and look to my left, I can see a library on the corner. That's where she learned to read. And she was fairly confident that she has been in this house that I'm currently in, that a friend of hers might have lived here growing up. So I thought that was kind of a weird and crazy connection that I had with her.
You're going to find like a sixth grade paper and it's going to say Diana Butler. Right.
Yeah, I'm still looking for that. I haven't quite gotten to like digging into the walls, you know, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful, you know, like a lost something I can publish, yeah. And you know,
yeah, you'll be rich and wealthy. The memoirs, the hidden memoirs of
Diana. Yeah, absolutely. Good deal. Well, that like I said, that class is going to be a lot of fun. I'll be sure to link, you know, all the links and stuff for people who would like to join. It's kind of pay what you can type deal, so we don't want, you know, money to exclude people. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. These pop-up communities have been helpful for me, you know, personally, so I'm personally excited. But I wanted to kind of talk to you specifically about the Cosmic Christ aspect of the class. But maybe I was thinking this might seem like a silly question, but also maybe not. I've discovered that some of my listeners who did not grow up in either more liturgical traditions or like mainline Protestantism might not know what Advent is. Like, they don't have the church calendar. So maybe we can cue them in a little bit to what even is Advent? What are we talking about here?
Mm-hmm. It's my favorite liturgical season. And it's one that a lot of people still know Holy Week, whether they were brought up in the church or not. You know, so we have Jesus coming to Jerusalem. We have, you know, the Last Supper on Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, so the day of the death on the cross. Easter, of course, on the Sunday. But the day in between is called Holy Saturday. And it's a day of kind of waiting in this balance between expectant hopefulness. Well, he did say something about rising on the third day, and just the sheer darkness. Our rabbi is gone. He's been crucified. We have this, we were duped. Everything we did, it was an illusion. The kingdom of God is not coming. That moment before Easter is very similar to Advent. This is the closest parallel. Advent is a period of waiting for the advent, for the coming. It's done within the symbol of light against the backdrop of darkness. So the shortest day of the year, at least now in the Christian calendar, is December 21. And those weeks, those Sundays, those four Sundays leading up to Christmas Eve are the period of Advent. For me, the most amazing period in the year, where Christians are supposed to shut up, listen, turn inward, imagine in this battle between darkness and light, this give and take between darkness and light that is our existence. Where do I stand right now? What do I hope for? What is the possible advent of God in the universe in physical form? What could that mean? That's the season of Advent.
Yeah, it's I was cued in a little bit because I grew up in a Methodist church. And so I kind of learned about Advent then. I worked in a Methodist church for a little bit, did some Advent then. But really, I've been kind of rediscovering most recently the season of Advent and really kind of falling in love with it again for exact, you know, some a lot of the same reasons you're saying. And I think
how would you put it?
Yeah, well, I love so for one, it's a paradox for me because I don't like the cold and I don't like it being dark all day. But at the same time, I love there's a certain kind of stillness and silence that comes when it's cold and dark outside. It's a different kind of silence than in the summertime, right? And there's something about that just naturally draws me inward. It feels more contemplative. And for me, the kind of contemplative tradition is really one that kind of grounds me, you know, because I have all these other outstanding questions, but the contemplative bit is something I appreciate. And also, I think since the last time we talked, I was still brewing professionally at the time. Now, I just had my 90-day performance evaluation as the parish administrator at a tiny little Episcopal church here in Maryland.
Cool.
And so, yeah, and I don't really know how I ended up there, but I'm there. And it's been really cool because we're preparing for Advent currently. I've been working on the bulletins and the liturgy and really have to be quite involved with it, you know.
Let's compare the two different approaches to Advent from two different they might seem like distant parts of the Christian world. So my practice is in a tradition that where silence is really central, which is the Quaker tradition or Religious Society of Friends. And for us, settling into worship is a time of deepening silence, of recognition and discovery of God in the silence. And we use the phrase of speaking out of the silence. So at liturgical season based on silence is the greatest thing a Quaker could want. You guys are like smells and bells and liturgy and words and stuff. So are you and I on opposite ends of the spectrum, or could we share something in common from those?
Yeah, that's interesting because I'm still very much learning the Episcopal liturgy and tradition. But yeah, I think it could have, you know, somewhat a seeming separation there. But for me, and I'm going to talk just experientially, one thing that I appreciate about the Episcopal tradition is the liturgical aspect. Like, I feel comfortable going and having the liturgy in my hands and knowing, like, verbatim exactly what's going to happen. You know, there's the rote prayers, which I used to diss, like, oh, those are just lukewarm Christians, you know, they're not really praying, something like that. But now, for me, that kind of, I don't want to call it a box, but this kind of, like, rote experience invokes contemplation for me. Even though it's lots of words, and, you know, they chant and do Latin and stuff, the form of it feels like I can just stand in this tradition while other people are praying these prayers with, you know, various levels of, like, mental assent to whatever they're saying. And it invites me into a contemplative space to be silent, because I'm standing in this tradition of words when people are saying things that I can't necessarily always say for myself. So I think they're close, even though maybe the method is different. Does that make sense?
Super cool. I want to take a huge leap because I think that takes us right into the middle of our discussion. On opposite ends of the spectrum, it would seem, is the silence with no liturgy whatsoever and the careful liturgical guide to worship, invitation to worship of the Anglican traditions, including American Episcopals, which is like the stretch between darkness and light that both of us said first when we thought of what Advent was, dark and cold outside, and yet the season of light. And the third parallel is that when we take this phrase, the cosmic Christ, it both signals a very located religion. We're talking about 2,000 years ago, one part of the world, one couple who gives birth to one child who lives one 33-year life, on the one hand, and on the other, cosmic Christ. It's like in Corinthians 1, the description of the Christ is this cosmic principle, or when John uses logos, word, at the beginning of John 1, a cosmic fundamental principle. Three different tensions, somehow all superimposed in today's topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And I think some language similar to that I have picked up and now stolen or borrowed from Tripp is he likes to talk about when we ask questions, we tend to ask them in different registers, and we can get confused or talk past each other when one person is asking the question from a particular register and another person is asking it from a different one. And so I think the three that I kind of want to point out is kind of the historical register, the existential register, and the metaphysical register. And so I think this cosmic Christ question can be asked in all three of those places, and maybe offer different, you know, as we were talking prior to starting, offer different starting places for people. And so for me, when I think about the cosmic Christ from an existential perspective, I'm cool there, right? I'm like, okay, I want to risk myself in the direction as if something like this is true because I find it beautiful. So I'm good on the existential bit. The historical register seems a little bit crazy to me, just the idea that, you know, the divine became or the infinite became finite, something like that. And I'm cool with that. It's definitely a leap of faith kind of thing. But I'm more comfortable just saying, like, Jesus was a person. I want to make sure that I hold on to, like, the Jewishness of Jesus. I know sometimes when this kind of conversation is had, people are accused of, like, trying to separate Jesus from Jesus's Jewishness. I don't want to do that. So that's kind of the historical stuff for me. But really, where I get excited is the metaphysical register. That's what, like, keeps me up at night. It's like, are we saying anything from a metaphysical perspective that I can ground myself in? That's where my mind goes these days. And I think all three of them are perfectly acceptable starting points. So I'm curious, maybe you, what's yours?
I want to say back to you what the three registers are. I mean, sort of, especially in light of the class that Tripp and Dan and I are going to be doing. But leave open the question, is one of them more prior than the others? And I don't know where you want to take our conversation after that, but that's the question that I probably struggle with the most. Is there a privileged starting point for a person who sees himself or herself as a disciple of this Jesus person? So the historical is the locatedness of this individual in a language, a culture, a really small land, insignificant at that time country, you know, on the banks of the Mediterranean. It is to tell, as you said, a very located story about a Jew, a brilliant Jew who knew the rabbis and knew Midrash and knew the scriptures. In a language who called God Abba, who had never heard of Christianity or creeds or Jehovah's Witnesses or mega churches, right? So there's that puzzling hyper-locatedness of Christianity, which is paradoxical, right? Then there is the metaphysical, the, and really for me, that encompasses the scientific as well. The biggest possible questions we can raise, you know, is an ultimate reality, the ground of everything that is that ultimate reality personal in nature? Is it one, two, or three persons? Is it, remember the debate at Wheaton when somebody spoke of Allah and God as words for the same reality? And she got in mega trouble for doing that because, no, clearly they couldn't be. But the metaphysician said, well, of course they have to be, right? And how is that tied in with the scientific story of a cosmos, 13.82 billion years old, arising in such and such ways, a planet, a sun that goes supernova in, you know, only 6 billion years, a universe which dies a heat death in 60 to 70 billion years, right? Here's this whole huge framework. And then tucked in between the hyperlocal and the hyperuniversal is the existential. What am I going to make of all of this? Where do I come down? I was brought up as an atheist and found something in the church that drew me. I was brought up in the church and I'm fleeing it as quickly as I could. And, you know, I'm lonely. I'm insecure. I feel anxiety. I'm on the spectrum. I would love to have a child before I'm 40. You know, all those things put together. I mean, isn't that the location, that the spread, the spectrum where we ask the questions that you keep asking on your podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very well said. That is the kind of the spectrum or where we find ourselves. And I think it's interesting, even just from a personal perspective, trying to become more aware of where I'm asking my questions from. That's been really helpful. For me and to kind of acknowledge like, oh, like this is, you know, I can take this group of questioning and lump it into this kind of category, which means I treat it very differently. Maybe I hold, I don't know, something like we're talking about metaphysics, even though I very much have my own perspectives and answers that I like better than others, perhaps I should hold them a little bit more loosely or be a little bit more open than, I don't know, something historic to me that I've known and experienced. I don't know. That seems a little bit more tight gripped, but also like now we have questions of experience. And what does that even mean? So,
you know, I didn't know how I was going to answer the question, but what you just said helps me see that one, I can't help but immerse myself in both. I mean, I have to say, I'm drawn to the story of Jesus. I'm, despite teaching it and knowing every criticism that can be raised, I continue to be drawn to those four stories, those four descriptions. Like, no, I mean, I teach comparative theologies. And so I often present Buddhism and Hinduism and Jainism and Taoism and Confucianism in the most positive light possible. But somehow for me, I remain drawn to that hyper-local story of Jesus walking into a city, meeting a blind man, encountering the teachers, right? At the same time, I can't help but ask the broadest questions possible. And I don't see them as exclusive. Oh, okay, here's an interesting way to put it. In some ways... The existential question, I know I'll die soon. What am I going to do with my life? You know, what will I have done? What's it all mean? Drives it and sends me to the Jesus in the dusty paths of Palestine on the one hand and into the cosmos as a whole on the other hand. And yet at the same time, those huge questions, the tension between the cosmos and the Christ, confront me with an existential dilemma. Do you see what I'm saying, Josh? It's like they go both directions.
No, absolutely. I'll try. Let's see if I can try to express the existential bit for me, because I think I'm with you. I still very much find myself attracted to and wanting to use the language of Jesus. And I think the Sermon on the Mount kicks ass. And I hope that I live my life in such a way that is informed by the ways and teachings, the life, death, resurrection of Jesus. But at the same time, it's almost as if that the particularity of Jesus kind of then pushes me to want to ask the big metaphysical questions, because I put so much stock into this, you know, first century Jew, you know, it pushes me into the metaphysical realm for some reason. And then they kind of, like you're saying, they talk to each other and inform one another. And so then the existential bit, for me becomes like, I don't know, like, I don't know if I have a good way to phrase it. Cause I mean, I love the question, you know, Aaron Simmons phrases it like, what's worthy of your finitude?
Mm-hmm.
And so an image and understanding of the divine, which I think Jesus does a really good job of expressing what that could be, gives me something that I could risk my life towards, you know, that's worthy of my finitude. And so perhaps the metaphysical is pushing me towards, like, maybe I'm looking for a little bit more, if I'm honest, like certainty, but I don't quite like that word, but I'm looking for a little bit more oomph behind my Jesus stuff to help me in my, you know, pursuit of like, is this something worth giving my life to? I don't know. It's an interesting tension there.
Okay.
You named it well.
So let me try, something came while you were talking. Maybe we don't want to take this tension that we've been describing and reduce it down to a single unified point, a set of propositions. I know that I don't, that I can't live with a Christianity, which is just like I was, my communicants class is a fifth grade member of the local Presbyterian church. And little 10-year-old came in and the pastor tried to make it all simple. And then you took a multiple choice test. And if you passed it, you got a little bread and a little grape juice. And I somehow decided that was highly desirable. And so everything had to be simple. I think Christianity got boiled down to sort of 12 multiple choice questions or short answer questions. I remember, for example, who is God? As you couldn't get to the grape juice unless you got this one right. And it was, I think I can still remember verbatim because it was important. It must have been good grape juice. God is a spirit, infinite and eternal in his being and perfections. And then you had to be able to list at least four perfections or you didn't make it to the grape juice. And they all started with omni, you know, omniscient, omnipotent, and so forth. That desire to boil Christianity down to just one equation will never work for me anymore, to be honest. But if we could have multiple pathways that we could go in different seasons of the year or different seasons of life, that would do it for me. So I think our conversation points to four. We get to ask the question about the universe and everything in it. And that's a huge question. We can do that in a very scientific way, or you can do it in a very speculative way, you know, like cosmologies across the world's traditions, okay? And second, we can ask that historical question, who was this Christ in his cultural context? You know, what was the Jewish people? What was their history? What was their situation at the moment that Jesus was born? What was a crucifixion and why was Jesus crucified, and on to the history of that. So that's the coming of Christ. Then we can talk about the practice of that. So the cosmology, the story of Christ, how do I join a community? What is Christian practice? What does Christian lifestyle mean as a third route? And the fourth and final one for me is ethical, moral, ethical, the transformation of the world, some calling to make the world a different place. For me as an environmentalist, that's picked up in the groaning of creation or the birth pangs of God. namely the climate crisis that we're stuck in. That pluralism of those four routes, doesn't that pick up on what you said a few minutes ago about registers, different registers?
Yeah, no, most definitely it does. And I know, I mean, I'm drawn to all four of them. Like the, it's so interesting. The, especially, I mean, I think for me, one of the reasons that I get excited about the kind of cosmic Christ language in the like really big sense is that in my mind, it's like, oh yeah, well, like obviously if people start believing this stuff, then they're going to start treating people better. And that's going to make them want to take care of the earth, and it's going to make blah, blah, blah. So like I jump there. I know that's where my mind goes within that kind of ethical, moral transformation aspect. And I guess, I don't know, transformation is kind of big for me. That's been something I've, you know, kind of a litmus test of sorts in my own spirituality and kind of faith, is asking questions of like, is this transformative? Is this calling me into something more beautiful? Yeah, so there's so much there. I don't know.
I don't know if I'm allowed to mention like a chapter of the Bible on your show, Josh. I don't know.
We don't really do Bible stuff here. No, but absolutely. Please do.
It's just because in this class with Tripp, I'm approaching the cosmology from one chapter in the Bible, in the book of Colossians, the first chapter. And it starts out like a lot of the letters, what we usually call the Pauline letters, with, you know, the hope of the community of Christ, the gospel is bearing fruit. And then there's a calling to good works and giving thanks to the Father and all this sort of stuff. But then he runs amok. Like by the 15th verse, he heads off from this very staid, traditional, for us now, Christian language, into the cosmos. I mean, just the sentence is great. The Son is the image of the invisible God. Okay. The firstborn over all creation. Okay. But then for in him, so in Christo is repeated 93 times in the New Testament. In him, all things were created. What do you mean? All things were created in Jesus? He's got to be a spacious person. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, thrones, powers, rules, authorities, everything. He's before all things, and in him all things hold together. And it continues in that vein. And now that's where the phrase cosmic Christ comes from. And I have to say, what I love about that is it's a complete mystery. Like, what the hell? How did we get from, hey, it's going well in the church in my city, how about yours, to all things are in this one? And that for me is such a mystery. It's such a non sequitur from, you know, our little stories of the gospels in fourth grade, that it leaves me with that, you know, what the heck mystery that I find so provocative and evocative, that it's become a major part of what draws me about Christianity, the sheer mystery of those words. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I love those. I love that passage. And I mean, I'm kind of with you. That draws me very much into both the like big picture, like cosmological, like metaphysical questions, but also that pulls on the heartstrings of my like more mystical side. As you know, you're talking about mystery. And you know, it also too, it reminds me a passage similar in John, you know, the prologue to John, in the beginning was the Word, and you know, in and through him all things were created, that kind of thing. Is again that great mystery. And for me, what happens there then is my mind goes, okay, is this somehow trying to make some kind of metaphysical claim? Can I use this to back up my understanding of like panentheism? Cause I really want to use it that way, or even, you know, to put whatever. But yeah, those passages for me are part of the reason that I still want to hang out in this Christian space, because it shows me just how big it can be. And like you said, I guess Jesus must be a pretty spacious person if all of these things kind of fit within him. And so maybe if all these things fit within him, then I can find myself fitting as well. And so it has that aspect too, a sense of belonging.
I really love the way that you brought in mystery. So I've spent a lot of my life doing that sort of metaphysics. I started my career with an 8-year book called The Problem of God in Modern Thought. I wrote it in German and then wrote it in English and spent the countless hours, thousands of hours in the Bavarian State Library reading these ancient texts and learning the most rationalistic arguments toward God, about God, doctrines of, you know, representing God to us. And like you, in the midst of this highly exact language, I found more mystery than exactitude. I had less the sense that we were really pinning it down now, right here with Neo-Thomism or here with Neoplatonism or whatever it was, less pinning it down and more finding an incredible space between the words, a space of a mystery that opens up in the strangest, unexpected places in the midst of our nice, neat theological claims, and a mystery that kind of it runs us through the words into some space beyond them where there is, and here we go again with Advent, where there's silence, some sense of, oh God, what did Wordsworth call it? A sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused. And there I mean more deeply than the words, more deeply than the 25 metaphysical views I could, you know, throw at right now. But it takes us to a place that I think is deeply true, a sense that we are somehow connected and that there is somehow meaning in it all. That's where it takes me, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also, it too invokes a sense of, at least for myself, of wonder and awe. And it's in a way that the kind of, you know, rote, you know, here's the theology test, you have to pass it, like you're talking about earlier, doesn't do for me anymore. The kind of wonder and awe that it inspires, kind of acts as a divine lure, if you will, that keeps me intrigued and interested. And also it invokes a sense of worship, right? Yeah. Because it is something that is so, you know, big and beautiful, beautiful, so beautiful that, like, I really hope it's true. I'm going to live as if it's true because it's beautiful, which I guess that then comes back to the existential bit, but
It's funny. Yeah. It was taking me to, so we are binding our different registers into a common key here.
Cool.
If I do the broad metaphysical positions, I also experience that, I called it the space of silence between the words. And I would use exactly the same words as you did, a kind of inherent awe and wonder. I read a global study once that found children, early age children, like 4 to 6 or something, around the world describing that kind of sense that seems to be a universal feature of humans. And when I feel that awe and wonder, then I look for something concrete, and somehow it turns me to the life of a first century Jew. Because the same awe and wonder is inspired for me in some ways by reading those gospels. And conversely, when the neat histories and pericopes, the stories, the parables seem too old and Sunday school-like, then my mind wanders sort of out the window and up, you know, to the stars. So there's a kind of mutual entailment, the ultra concreteness of those stories about Jesus, the vastness, awe-inspiring vastness of the universe, feel like we journey back and forth between them when we live into the depths of our human nature.
Yeah. All right. So I'm curious, where in this kind of conversation, where is it that you find doubt coming into it. Because, so I know one of the books that you wrote was like, I'm going to butcher the title, forgive me, but it was about like wrapping your faith in doubt. And so I'm curious, because like, I get excited, right, about the big metaphysical stuff. And then like the Jesus story is really compelling, like we've talked about. But then even though the two inform each other, for me, where doubt starts to creep in is like, okay, but is this like really something that I can say happened in a specific time, location, and place? I want it to be true. Like previously when my faith was a lot more rote and stable, in the sense that like I checked the boxes, the incarnation was the biggest thing for me. You know, people do their theology from different places, like incarnation, resurrection, crucifixion. It was always the incarnation for me. But like doubt starts to creep in there. And so I'm curious for you, like does doubt creep in, and like how does that kind of inform or play with some of your thoughts in this kind of cosmic mm-hmm. Christ conversation?
Yeah. So we Steve Knapp and I did do a book on doubt called The Predicament of Belief. And we're really a few years ago, we're actually writing the sequel to it now called Hope Beyond Belief. But somehow belief, either in the details of Jesus' life or in the science of the universe, gives rise to a kind of doubt. And I think that's where I would go with your question. So when in Sunday school or Young Life or Campus Crusade or Westmont College, which was pretty conservative back in the days when Diana Butler Bass and I were there, when in the midst of that, the story of Jesus, this is deeply personal, I realize now, is too neatly tied together. And the professor finishes, you know, the lecture on five main themes in Luke, and with a kind of smug smile, he snaps his Bible closed, grabs those papers together on his podium the way that professors do in that irritating way, shoves it all in his briefcase, turns to us with a self-satisfied smile, and spinning on his heel, walks back to his office hour in his office upstairs. I think, nah, it can't be that simple, right? I have Jewish friends. You know, they've just been dissed by this whole narrative, right? This is all against them somehow, it felt at the time. Or, you know, I met this amazing Hindu guy once, and I just sensed a depth of spirituality. You know, I listened to this lecture by this Buddhist nun, and I just had a sense of vastness in this world she inhabits. Okay, so you mean the restlessness pushes me out of the clean system. Something similar happens in cosmology, but see what you think about this. I am fascinated by the being able to take what we can know about physics on this planet and extrapolating it out to the ends of the universe, and then finding that the bloody thing actually does work that way, that light incoming from 300,000 years after the Big Bang, so it's been traveling for over 13 billion years, shows the same laws and patterns as terrestrial physics. And that's just absurd. All right, so I'm drawn to that. And yet, in all that universe, where is there anything alive? Where is there anything like us? There's no sign that there's a creature somewhere that looks up into the skies and says, what's it all mean? And what's my place in it? Could we be like this absurd, you know, intelligent animal that happened to have risen on a particular planet? Nietzsche has an early writing, and he was 16, and he said, you know, once on a small planet in a distant corner of the galaxy, intelligent life arose, but it was only a moment, for that intelligent animal had to die. That meaninglessness that, you know, you can, that science just leaves you looking at. And then I want to take refuge in a clearer story. Do you see the back and forth?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think you named it well. I'm with you. And yeah, I think that's where, when I do, cause I go through these like different times in my life when I'm hyper-focused on something. So I'll sit down and I'll read a whole bunch of stuff about like, quantum physics. Right. Or then I'll sit down and I'll be like, okay, now I'm really interested in this whole, like, you know, philosophy of mind, what is consciousness thing, blah, blah, blah. And I'll get like sidetracked and go do deep dive into that. And then ultimately I'm like, well, wait a minute, like, this is all really cool, but something feels missing. Like, where's my meaning piece? Where's the meaning making aspect? And that's when I find myself wanting to return to the mystics or to, you know, my, like, I don't know, basic, like, Jesus loves me, this I know kind of thing, right? Yeah. Because it brings that element back in. And yeah, it's I don't know. I only laugh because I think it's so relatable.
Could we say that there's something of the human condition in that, something right in that? And maybe we're just an animal that needs to live in multiple registers. I mean, I like being a dad and, you know, taking care of the needs of little kids and then as they get older. But I like... I went hiking in the highlands of Scotland after some recent lectures, and to climb a mountain is called to bag a Monroe. So you leave and you head up into the mist. And this was like 2,000 stairs, climbing 2,000 feet to this peak, which is like shrouded in mist and darkening Scottish sky, and no sense of orientation up or down, an adventure and open-endedness that my soul needs. But then I want to go down that mountain and call the kids. And maybe that is could it be that itself is a location, that we're the animal that needs that open wild space, you know, looking out on the shore over the shore of the Pacific, watching the sunset on the one hand, and then, you know, doing the dishes and putting the kids' clothes on in the morning. I don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm with you, which is, I wonder, this is so curious, because now I'm putting these two together in my head. I wonder if this why I like something like, you know, process relational thinking and theology, philosophy, etc. It gives me that big kind of openness thing. But then I also really love the mystics and the contemplatives and the, like, hey, God is found in the mundane. Like, if you want divine unity, set the bar lower, right? Not higher. Don't look in the mountain peaks per se, but like, look at the blades of grass or a tree or your pet's eyes, whatever. So like, there's that, like, both and. And I wonder if they're serving those kind of, you know, two different purposes. There's spaces that exist within me.
So think of encountering other religions. Like, since early in my career, I've had the privilege of going to different countries and talking to the philosophers and theologians there about their beliefs, and then representing them to students in philosophy classes or in seminary classes. And I have to say that it is my task in a Christian seminary to bring the Buddha alive in a way that it's as if I would want to convert all my Christian students to Buddhist, by really letting them see the attractiveness of this, or describing possibly the world's greatest mystical text in the Hindu tradition, the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna in the chariot in the war is thinking, why am I fighting a war against my cousins? And the charioteer, turns around, the one who's guiding the chariot, and turns out it's Krishna, like the highest manifestation of the divine, who then answers his questions and gives him this mystical vision of the unity of all things. And I mean, I can bring goosebumps to, you know, the shoulders of every student in the classroom, you know, tears about a story. And yet when I leave that classroom, I know somehow at the end of the day that there is one rabbi that's orienting for my life. Do you see how that might be an analog to the cosmic questions and a liturgy that one repeats week by week that is a kind of home space?
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think that's really beautiful. I mean, I personally, one of my more recent obsessions, as I was telling you, I get hyper fixated on things, has been religious pluralism and interfaith dialogue. That's part of what I'm writing my master's thesis on right now. So it's really exciting, but it's been, I mean, I've had a similar experience where I have really enjoyed, you know, learning about and looking at different traditions and things like this and seeing the beauty in them. But then always coming back to, maybe it's just because it's familiar language to me, but the language that my Christian tradition has given me, and not in such a way that feels hierarchical, I guess. Like, I don't want to be like, okay, well, everybody else, their stuff is nice, but obviously, like, they're wrong, kind of thing. And so, like, I found people like Cobb and Griffin helpful in, like, their deep religious pluralism kind of thing. But yeah, that the return is curious to me. And yeah, I don't know. And then that return always, once again, wants to push me out to this cosmic Christ question. It sends me there.
It makes me think of that phrase from T.S. Eliot. See if I could pull it out. We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. I much more love that sense of knowing it for the first time than what I was taught as a young evangelical, which is, because this is true, all the rest are false. And what you just did was avoid that phrase, because this is true, all the rest are false. So could it be that we can journey to places to learn to be transformed by, you know, the Buddha, the Arjuna, and then come back to the place which is home and know it in a deeper way, that it's in some way more deeply home, without having said that all the places I encountered on my journeys were false and meaningless and to be discarded in comparison? And what if the phrase the cosmic Christ gives us that permission? What if that juxtaposition of two inconceivable words is exactly that space? So the Christ is this very located first century individual, Jesus. The cosmic is the universe and everything in it. And then we come back and unite them in a kind of, here we go, mystical unity that doesn't exclude anything we explored along the way, but can represent a home.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think you named it well. I think that's where the freedom comes from. So I have a buddy named Jed, who has asked me before, and I've heard him say on other podcasts that he was like, you know, like, Josh, you have such a sense of freedom in your, you know, questioning and whatever. And he asked me where that's grounded in. And I often don't have like a very good response to that. I'm like, I don't know. I just ask questions. It's part of my personality. But I think this cosmic Christ understanding actually lends itself nicely to that. In such a way where it's like the cosmic Christ is something that I keep coming back to this language, but I risk myself in the direction of that being true. And then from that space, from that, like, not belief, but faith, act of faith, it opens me up to the world, not closes me off from it. And I think that's really interesting.
I love the phrase you just used. I risk myself in the direction of that being true. I could almost imagine a podcast that would start in with that risk, call it faith, and then would give permission to think about anything, or to rethink anything, and then to circle back again to that place, that risk, that faith, and know it as if for the first time. Rethinking Faith.
Oh, that'd be a cool podcast. Maybe somebody ought to get that going. Have a good start on that. Listeners, you heard it here first. There's your $1 million idea.
It's the different registers, as we've just kind of wandered into it, is more like an adventure, like a journey, than it is like a location. It's about, I mean, I know this fits for me, constantly being the prodigal son. I'm the dude that's always out in the wrong place, asking the wrong question and hanging out with the wrong kind of folks, but wanting to come back in a cycle. That is rethinking faith for me, actually.
Yeah, that's a beautiful image. I really like that. And I think for me, that I can kind of see that kind of playing out throughout my own life, because I remember it was a lot of things, but part of why I felt the need to step away from vocational ministry as a pastor was because I felt like I didn't fit the mold. Like, well, I don't really feel like a pastor. Look at all these kind of like questions that I'm asking or something like that. And my conception at the time of Christianity, when I was making this, you know, decision to leave, was one in which Christianity was more so that set of propositions, that like thing that if I said it right, I got the grape juice. whereas now I feel like the way that I see Christianity is less that and more so a way of being in the world, where I'm free to ask the questions and wrestle with things, but still live my life as if this reality of like the cosmic Christ or something like that is true. And that brings the kind of transformation, the ethical, moral bit that you mentioned earlier. It feels like it invites me into that space where I can live in the ways of Jesus, where hopefully I can love my neighbor. And on days when I'm really not, you know, being shitty, I can even love my enemy. even while still having all these big questions out here that I don't really necessarily have 100% certainty on answers to, or even 50% certainty.
You know, what's really super cool is that, in fact, where this fascinating conversation has taken us is to, it implies a notion of community that is richer than what we usually think of when we think of a church community. That phrase to me became, after Westmont and Fuller, such a homogenous phrase. It's kind of like when I've spent a month in China or a month in India and come back and it seems like everybody's white and they all speak with an American drawl and I feel nausea. So could we have a community? I think we can, where some people are really comfortable in that home space. Maybe they're older than us. They kind of grew up in the church and they will come out with us on the adventure. They're not afraid. They're not judgmental. But when they come back into that sort of church space, they feel more at home. Then there are some of us who kind of loop around like the prodigal son, but come back in a regular way and do feel like we know it for the first time. But then there's some of us who are really wanderers in our deepest nature. And you can see when they come to the Bible study, I was like this, or they come into the church building, there's a little awkwardness. Like, no, this isn't really home, you know? It's not the synagogue I grew up in. It's not the culture I grew up in Japan or whatever. And they keep that kind of air, that sense of fresh air and another space with them when they're in the church world. Like, not totally comfortable, but wanting to be there for a time. Do you see what I mean? Like, maybe it's okay that we come down on different places in this spectrum.
Yeah, I would hope so. It kind of reminds me of the idea of like the body of Christ, right? With different parts or something like that. The body of Christ isn't a monolith, right? Like if, the body of Christ was just like, white dudes with beards and PhDs, like it'd be kind of boring, right?
For damn sure.
It might be, you know, kind of cool because we'd be included, but like that's boring. Like, I don't know that I want to be included. But having that kind of space for the different kinds of people, I think is a vision worth giving myself to. Mm-hmm. And that's so interesting to me too. I'm going to return to this phrase that I pulled. I want to say I heard Rob Bell talking about it, where he referenced this idea that in people's own kind of like faith journeys, if you will, that you kind of just have to let them have their trip, right? Yeah. That each person's faith journey is unique to them. And so for me, that was really difficult at first because when I was first, you know, questioning things and to use the word deconstructing, which wasn't really quite a thing yet, that phrase wasn't as popular yet. For me, it kind of became a phrase I lived into, but goodness, where was I going? Stupid deconstruction. I need to stop qualifying that when I bring that word up.
It's like apologizing for it.
Right, apologizing for it. But the goodness gracious, they killed my train of thought. Let people have their trip. When I was deconstructing, I was like, everybody needs to be doing this because like duh. And that calls me to say things that I wish I could take back. There's probably, you know, podcast episodes that I wish didn't exist. things like this. But also then it's like given me hopefully a better appreciation. Like watching, for example, the first time I went to an Episcopal church and I brought down the age by like 50 years easily. And the congregation was maybe like 15, 20 people. But watching them live into these liturgies and perform these liturgies was so beautiful and inspiring to me. I was like, oh, I'm missing something. Like this is real for these people. This matters. And so I want to have a space where the kind of really committed and they're like comfortable. I know that I know this kind of thing. Like I want a space for them in the church in the same way that I hope there's a space for wanderers or prodigal sons or daughters or whatever kind of thing. That's really interesting. I hope that's true.
So your answer takes me to a place that I find freeing. I don't think I've ever seen this before. All those different kinds of people that make up a community, the one that just seems to belong in those church grounds or sanctuary or, you know, fellowship hall with coffee and styrofoam cups with V for visitor. you can tell which kind I am. Or on the other end, the person who barely seems to be able to sit still through a service, who would rather sit in the back right corner of the back pew to signal that she's really not, a member. I'm not a member. No, I'm not a member, right? I'll be out of here in a sec, but needs to come into that space. That makes me think of a poem by Phil Luckin that we should look at in a sec. What if I get to be all those people at different seasons of my life? There were times when it really is a home space, when I was so comfortable there and it was a kind of pinnacle of the week. And I remember the time when my faith deconstructed, interestingly, through Fuller Seminary. And I went home and my mother said, well, I go to a Quaker meeting. I hardly even heard what that was. And we sit in silence for a week. And I had to sit on that for a couple of days. And then I said to myself, I don't believe in God anymore. I don't have a faith right now. You know, I that got deconstructed by, well, we won't go into the details of which professors at Fuller Seminary deconstructed it. But I do know that I'm going to die someday. Like, I'm sure of that. And I think that's worth 1 hour of my week. I'm going to go there and I'm just going to sort of look around the room at these older people. And I'm going to say, hey, I'm not immortal. This is a really short journey I'm on. And I'm going to think of how I want to live. How did I live this last week? And how do I want to live the next week? That's the only thing that gets me to sit in this chair. I think it's incredible that all of those could be authentic ways to come to a so-called place of worship.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of this experience I had recently where I was sitting here in this chair and looking at my three overflowing bookshelves and looking at the different books there. And some of them I was like, oh, wow, I remember when I read this. This is so helpful. Really cool. I love this book. And then, you know, I'd keep going and be like, oh, why is this here? I can't believe I actually read this. This is cringy. Like, do I need to hide this so other people don't know that it's here? You know, if and when I have kids one day, do I really want them reading this? But then coming to this kind of recognition in that space, like, oh yeah, but also that book was really helpful at a time. And so like, in a way, these bookshelves represent like past versions of Josh.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And without them, you know, current Josh wouldn't be who I am. And so there's kind of this like grace and compassion towards myself that stems from grace and compassion towards past versions of Josh, who's just like kind of doing the best with what he had at that time. Yeah. kind of thing. And I think that's beautiful.
There's such an acceptance there. I remember, you know, you often hear preachers who have to preach on Matthew 5, and they get to this 48th verse, be perfect even as your heavenly Father is perfect. And they say, nah, the noun, the adjective here is teleos. And teleos doesn't just mean absolute perfection. It means we're perfect for that stage of our particular life. So like the grape is perfect for its maturing toward that point where it can be picked. You know, so I'm a soccer referee for kids, and the 10-year-old soccer player is perfect for a 10-year-old on a field. Like, she's playing so well for that stage of her life. 8 years later, you know, she's either going to be, you know, on women's World Cup team, or she's going to be, you know, not playing soccer anymore. But right now, it's perfect. If we could really say that about every phase of our life, wouldn't that be incredible? And if the gospel isn't, you're judged for every phase because you're getting it wrong all the way through, and instead is all those occasions, as we say in process thought, all those moments, each one has its own perfection, just like there's a perfection in each person who finds themselves in that community on a Sunday morning or Thursday night or whatever. That would be the most redemptive, if I could believe that, the most redemptive thing I could possibly believe, that all the Phillips or all the Joshes are, hey, just okay. It's like totally fine to read that weird book or to believe that thing or to doubt it all. That would be grace if that were true.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of something you referenced earlier, that passage in Colossians, that all of these things, all of these past versions of Josh and Philip belong and are somehow present in Christ. I don't know how, but somehow they're there in the cosmic Christ. That's, yeah, you're right. That is grace. And that is something that is transformative and beautiful. And if I could believe it for myself, then maybe my wife, you know, would get mad at me less or something.
I think it is. I mean, I think I'd want to affirm that. If all things are in Christ, then it's all the different pieces without exception. You can't have it both ways. I remember, after I became a panentheist, and that was pretty unacceptable in my evangelical circles, I had a debate at a certain very conservative seminary where 25 people lined up around this long table with me at the lower end, clearly, and told me why panentheism was unacceptable, because it would make God present to sin, and that couldn't be. And I realized at that moment that I could not do otherwise. Here I stand, I can do no other, said Luther. I couldn't do otherwise than take that position, because the deepest thing I believed about God was that God was a presence that could be present to the darkest things in the world, the darkest moments in my life, the darkest moments or types of persons ever lived on this planet, and didn't have to turn away in revulsion, and is such that God would not be corrupted by being present to that space with just love, acceptance, and grace. And panentheism for me, you know, all things are in God and God is in all things, says that more than anything else. Just a complete acceptance, a compassion that recoils from nothing, is not disgusted by any aspect of myself or any other person ever. And wow, I mean, if that, what we're doing about all the moments being perfect and included still in the Christ, that I find a very, very powerful proclamation, belief, hope.
Yeah. Amen. And if, you know, you want to put that into some, you know, my mind goes in the kind of processy direction where if God is constantly taking in, if you will, each moment of becoming perfectly into the divine self and being shaped and transformed by that, even the darkness, even the ugliness, even the sin, if you want to use that language, but still in each moment, as those things are being brought in perfectly into the divine and, you know, existing forever objectively within the divine experience, something like that. But in each moment of becoming, God is still alluring, calling us into the good, the beauty, beautiful, the true, you know, kind of moving things into that direction. Then yeah, it's like, of course, those things belong, and there's grace for that. And even with those things, I'm still invited into this kind of participatory, co-creative act of whatever the fuck it means to be human, trying to work towards things that are good and beautiful and true. And that's, I'm willing to give my life to that. That's a pretty big vision of grace.
That notion that you just described is so amazing. I hadn't ever thought of it in light of today's conversation, but you know, the process theology says that every moment and every thought of myself is taken eternally into the mind of God. It becomes is called objective immortality. It's not lost. And what's sent back at every moment is a lure to the greatest potential that lies within me. My predecessor here in the Ingram chair, Marjorie Suhaki, wrote several books. Maybe the most profound was called The End of Evil. And she really settled into what it would mean that nothing about us, not a single thought, needed to be censored or rejected by God, but could be taken into the eternal divine memory, become a part of the experience of God, without harming God in any way. And what comes back in the next moment is the calling to be yourself and a little better. And that utter acceptance, and at the same time, the standard to grow. Man, like, what else would you want to make central to your life?
Boom, roasted, the cosmic Christ. Excuse me. Yeah, that I love Marjorie Suhaki and her work. I didn't realize she was your predecessor. That's pretty cool. I've read a few of her books, not all of them, but she came highly recommended at the hand of Trip Fuller. So I've been enjoying her.
And just to spell it for your listeners, Suchoki, Suchoki, Marjorie. She has God Christ Church, I think, is the textbook I've probably taught most often. And it's just a really simple, compassionate understanding of God Christ Church from the standpoint of a process theologian.
Yeah, I'll link, I'll make a note to link those resources since they came up in conversation for the listeners so they can find them easily. But I guess as you know, our time is dwindling down here. We've kind of talked about many things. Is there, you know, what, how would you like to kind of land the plane here? How would you like to kind of summarize, you know, or tie up any loose ends that you might see from our conversation today?
Well, I'll mention a book title that, not to plug it, but just because it, it captures, I think, where the conversation took us. I have a collection of pieces called Adventures in the Spirit. The in has been accompanying us all the way through this conversation. You know, when all things are in Christ, that was that phrase, kind of the way we defined the cosmic Christ early in our conversation. In the spirit, so we're thinking about not just the laws of science, but some sort of enveloping divine presence that you and I and many of us struggle to understand. We're aware of the inadequacy of our answers, the mystery of all this language. And we're aware that that word is also a part of a liturgy that Christians around the world repeat, you know, in a weekly basis. So it, and then the first word, however, was I think the one that was most the salt and pepper of this conversation, adventures. And there was no point where we had to censure either one of us or pull back and they say, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Somehow this space, Rethinking Faith, gave us the chance to do all that exploring. Looking back, I think some of my metaphors were more limited or, you know, superficial, but others, a part of that adventure felt profound. And that is a calling. Listen, Adventures in the Spirit is a calling to think boldly. Sky's the limit, literally, to believe boldly, even, you know, I will never believe without doubt, but to believe with doubt, and to act boldly. That's how it feels like the pieces come together for me.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that summarizes things nicely. Think boldly, believe boldly, with doubt, and to act boldly, and I'm glad that the act boldly aspect or the transformative piece came up, because often, you know, I get so hung up in the big ideas out here, and they're just kind of cool and fun and abstract ideas to play with, but then it's like, okay, cool, well, so what, Josh? Like, what are you going to do with that kind of thing? And so I think the kind of call to action and transformation, not in a way that's, you know, forceful or manipulative or something like that, but rather a true call into something beautiful, I think is a great way to kind of to wrap things up. So.
Yeah. Because as abstract as our conversation got, it was still always about ways of being in the world.
Yeah.
Like we always brought it back to what is it like to be in the world if you're thinking in this way? And to be in the world is to act boldly. So in a sense, this was a conversation about action.
Right. Crazy. The cosmic Christ brought us to action. I love it. man, well, thank you again so much for your time and for hanging out. I've really appreciated this conversation, and hopefully there are many more to come in the future. I'm selfishly, that's a hope for myself.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh. It was you're a great host, and it was really fun to take this adventure in the spirit with you today. So yeah. Thanks.
Well, thank you for joining me in the adventure. And listeners, thank you as well for hanging out and tagging along in the adventure. I'm glad that you're here, and excited to see where our adventure takes us next. But I guess until next time, guys, go in peace.